Hi, this is Zach Hoskins from the blogs Dystopian Dance Party and Dance Music Sex Romance, and what you're about to hear is the first of several parts of my conversation with Jane Claire Jones. We got on the phone or on Skype last weekend and talked for about 6 hours, 4.5 of which were recorded. Obviously, no one's going to listen to all of that in one sitting, so I've broken it up into a few. In this first episode, you're going to hear us talk about basically why we've both spent the last year in some level of obsessive activity related to Prince. I think we make a pretty good case. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you again for the remaining installments in the weeks to come.
Let's work! Let's work! Let's work! Let's work! I wanna say something, yeah. All right, I'm working on it.
I'm here with Jane. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, I am Jane. Is that a satisfactory introduction?
That's fine. Yeah, and I'm Zach.
Thank you.
We'll talk about ourselves more in a little bit.
Well done.
And Jane actually suggested to me that we do a podcast for April 21st, because we have both been immersed in our
obsessing is the word, Zach.
We've been fairly obsessed with Prince since April 21st of last year, for obvious reasons. And we've been kind of doing our own separate projects. We kind of found each other through those, and we've had a lot of conversations about Prince, and we decided, why not inflict those on the rest of the world
out of the goodness of our hearts.
Right, exactly. So we've got a little bit of a structure here, but I think it's going to be fairly free form too. We thought we would start with talking about how we got here, I guess. Why have we spent the last year, so obsessed with a person who is, honestly, for most people, maybe kind of an interesting figure, a charismatic performer who had an awful lot of hits and wrote a lot of great songs that may or may not have been hits, but not everyone has been as fully consumed by Prince as I think we have. I think it's worth asking, like, why him and how did we get here?
Should we start with how did we get here?
Thank you. to start? Because I think chronologically, your story might be earlier than mine.
Yeah, because I'm a back in the day. I'm a back in the day girl originally. I was a back in the day girl, and then I took a long, long leave of absence from. Well, it wasn't an abrupt leave of absence. I think it was a leave of absence that happened gradually. Yeah, I mean, my story's quite similar to when I wrote the piece that I wrote, which was one of the reasons that we kind of got in touch with each other. After I wrote it, I received a really large number of emails from other women who were basically like, this thing has hit me like a ton of bricks. And women of a similar age, particularly women who were, you know, in their early, mid, late teens, in the mid-80s, basically, to whom, you know, he played a very significant role for us. As part of that kind of Michael Jackson, Madonna, Prince triumvirate, but I think also specifically him. And so there was that. There was a very strong identification with him when I was... So how old am I? So I was actually a little bit young for Purple Rain. So the first album that I owned was Parade. And Sign of the Times was really my album. And then I went back... And I got Purple Rain, and I got Around the World in a Day, and I had some knowledge of Dirty Mind, but I never, I mean, it's really interesting kind of looking back on that period now in terms of what our access was now. I mean, it's really difficult for the generations that exist now to understand that, but you know, you went to Woolworths and you looked in the record, like, section, and you bought the records that were there, and maybe if you were lucky, there was an independent record. They were there or not. So I went back and I looked, and there was Parade. Obviously, I had that. Then I bought that, and then I, you know, and I went back, and there was Purple Rain, and I bought that. And then at some point, I rented the VHS from the video store, and you know, I read smash hits, and there would be occasional articles or whatever. But I mean, you didn't have the access to the kind of material. So I think one of the things that happened to my generation of women, particularly, who had a very strong identification with him when we were at a very formative age, and when he died, that really, there was some kind of time traveling that happened where we went back to, and to me it was very visceral. It was weird. I was at a party the Saturday after he died, and we were all like, what just happened? We stayed up, you know, we tried to get the hits that we could, which at that point was still really hard to get on the internet. So we downloaded what we could from various places and put together a you know, there was no Spotify, it was useless. So we put together what we could. I mean, people actually bought things. I think people went places and bought what they could, and for us to, you know, get the songs that we needed for that particular kind of, we're going to dance in memory and celebration kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was all, we were all, you know, we're all in our mid-40s. So it was all of us revisiting that. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, we sat down and listened to Purple Rain in its entirety, or what we could get of it. and it was like some kind of weird TARDIS experience. I'm trying to explain what happened, but I just had some incredibly strong visceral response to it. And I came back the next day with a bad hangover, and by that point, stuff was starting to flood onto the internet.
Right.
And it was like a flood. It was like a, you know, like floodgates opening. Suddenly there was just all of this stuff, and it happened really, really quickly. And I mean, obviously this didn't happen to everyone, but a lot of the women that wrote to me afterwards, I mean, I wrote that piece in June. So it was about seven weeks after he died, I wrote it. And the response I got from women was like, I have been stuck in my bedroom watching these videos on YouTube for like the last 6 weeks. And it's like, it's blowing my head off. Yeah. Like, and we'd never seen that stuff. Because he didn't want us to see it. So there was no sense of chronology. There was no sense of, there was just, you know, we had, We had what we'd experienced in real time, like what we saw on Top of the Pops, what we picked up, and then, you know, yes, there are hardcore fans and they got really into it and they did the work to get hold of that stuff. But you had to, you either had to be hardcore or quite superficial. There wasn't much in between, there wasn't much space in between. And I wasn't. He was really, really important to me. Then the whole, you know, I mean, I think from Love Sexy to kind of Diamonds and Pearls to the Assless Pants was a kind of a gradual tapering. And then by the time we got to the Assless Pants slash name change, you know, I was just kind of like, yeah, whatever, dude. and dance music happened. I mean, he was really, really important. And then he was just nowhere at all in terms of, you know, any kind of presence, really. There was the rumbling in the background about the name change, and then there was nothing. And there were the comeback tours. And I mean, this is the place that I'm really upset. This is retrospectively what I'm really upset about, is that I was on the wrong side of the ocean for both of the comeback tours. So I was in Europe during the Musicology tour, and then I went to grad school in the States just before the O2 gigs in London, which would have been the point at which I would have gone, oh, you're back.
Yeah.
and so that went over my head as well. And, you know, I was vaguely aware he was still around, but it wasn't pressing until it became pressing, and then it became pressing like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there was something in the air. I mean, a friend of mine was saying to me the other day, like, that he's noticed a lot of graffiti, you know, like bits of lyrics and little images and the symbol, like, appearing on walls. It feels to me like people really responded emotionally to it, and I'm interested about what that's about, actually, as well. And how much it's connected to the release of the material that happened after his death. Also, what we were talking about the difference between him and his performance of himself as a superstar, and how that flooded into mainstream culture, and all of the other stuff, most of which was concealed unless you were really looking for it.
Yeah.
And then when you realise it just kind of takes your head off, you know. Then I was kind of like, oh my god, there's so much music, how did you record all this music, this is insane.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we can spend like a year, you know, paddling around in Prince's, you know, psychic Lake Minnetonka. Like, you know, there's just so much. There's so much that not only in quantity, but in richness,
in range. I mean, this is one of the points that I had in my list of like, what is significant about him under the kind of general genius virtuosity, kind of the first point, you know,
right.
The range is insane.
Yeah.
The range is insane.
And you
know,
the,
I mean,
he's credible at most things, you know, like I wouldn't go so far as to say that he can do everything equally well, but I can't think of many artists with that kind of range. The Beatles might come the closest, where they can be credible at a wide range of different kinds of music. And maybe not all of them are equally good, but it's impressive just that they can do it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think his range is, in, yeah, is actually far in excess of theirs. I mean,
yeah.
I was talking to my dad about this because it turns out my dad doesn't like Prince, because I was just kind of like, I just assumed that he would. And then I came back with all this stuff and I was like, listen to all this stuff. And he was just like, nah. And then, you know, about 3 weeks into me trying to get him into it, he told me he didn't like Hendrix. And then I was like, all right, okay. I don't know why I'm bothering. Like, I'm going, like, forget it.
I give up.
Yeah. And then I give up. Like, I don't even know where to start with that. And also my dad has this whole thing. I played in there were definitely particular moments in that journey where I went from being like, I'm feeling really compelled to like, you've totally blown my head off. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the Montreux 2009 performance.
I remember meeting you here in the good old days,
the 80s.
I would never pick the flower of my favorite protege.
It's better now.
Maybe if I would have, you would not treat me this way. Oh, you tricked me.
When I first saw that, and I still, you know, it still gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, in terms of the range, that I think it's interesting because Susan Rogers said something about how she thinks his greatest strength was like crafting pop melody, and I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Really? Like, you were in the studio with him and when he recorded the Ballad of Dorothy Parker, and you think pop melody was...
Right.
Really? Like, I don't understand that. I mean, because I actually think that's one of his weakest areas. If you want strength of pop melody, or, you know, then you go to the Beatles.
Right.
For sure.
Well, that's touches upon another thing that's kind of interesting about him. And I realize that I haven't given my biography yet, but we'll jump around. I think another thing that's interesting and that I've noticed very profoundly in the months since his death is there are many princes, you know, there are, like, everyone kind of has their own.
Yeah.
And you can see, you know, so there's like a whole group of people who, when they think, you know, when they hear that Prince died, the first things they think of are the Super Bowl or, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, his guitar solo and the George Harrison song.
Yeah.
And so there's people who praise him as a guitar hero. There's people like Susan Rogers who think of him as a pop craftsman, which he certainly, I mean, I definitely agree with you. It's very debatable whether that was his principal strength. But, you know, anybody who wrote Raspberry Beret is certainly up there, you know, like some of he has written some like just perfect pop songs.
No, they are perfect pop songs. I think probably and it's not that I don't like pop songs.
Right.
I just, out of all of the things I like about him, liking his pop songs is one of the least important.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't think they're good pop songs. Raspberry Beret is a perfect pop song. Little Red Corvette is a perfect pop song.
Right.
But if I want pop, I want poppy pop, really,
right.
Poppy pop. Like, I'd rather go to Madonna or something really poppy.
Yeah.
Which is, and I mean, these things are subject. I mean, there's an interesting thing insofar as there are elements of it which are subjective, and then there's also elements in which there's actually quite a lot of agreement about what the standout performances are.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I think in the grand scheme of things, the Super Bowl performance was epic for its theatricality, but mm-hmm. musically it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't that interesting in terms of what he could actually do on a stage.
Yeah, I felt the same way, and you know, part of it was I was kind of a lapsed fan at the time. I certainly appreciated it, you know, because it was great and because it was better than most Super Bowl performances. You know, I'd watch him.
Yeah, without question.
You know, but that wasn't what I went back to. So I thought it was interesting, almost on like an anthropological level, just seeing like what was your Prince, you know, that everybody yeah. kind of reflected on. Similar thing happened with David Bowie. It was, you know, like some people went to Labyrinth and it was like, that's interesting. Like that your David Bowie was Labyrinth Bowie, you know, like, not necessarily my David yeah. Bowie, although I love Labyrinth, but it's always interesting to see what it is that connects with people, because it can be incredibly diverse.
So why don't you say what is most important to you? I mean,
yeah,
weave it into your story in terms yeah. of what your journey was.
So the thing that I keep coming back to, you may or may not know if you're listening to this. I'm guessing if you're listening to this, you know. I have a blog where I'm going through all of Prince's songs from beginning to end. Because I want to punish myself, I guess.
it's such an epic mission.
I try not to think about it as much as I can. Like every time I finish yeah. an album, I feel this sense of like achievement, and then I'm like, there are 38 more released albums to go, and that's not even counting, you know, his side projects, the stuff that's leaked and more is leaking. And anyway, you know, I may actually die before I finish this.
But there's going to be some points where it's going to get tough as well.
Yeah, you know? Definitely. I'm dreading. I have a similar, even though, you know, we're from different continents and different generations, but in terms of my preferences in his music, I think we both kind of fall within the mainstream. You know, most people, Prince peaked in the 80s, declined in the 90s. Maybe he got us back in the 2000s, maybe not. You know, it's in my case, it's kind of there was a lot of back and forth in the 2000s.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably true of most people also. You know, Prince fans yeah. are Prince fans can be a little more diverse in their assessments of his career. But I feel like the critical consensus is basically what you described.
Yes.
I'm writing this blog, and I think I've mentioned a couple times, you know, in the course of just like thinking about his songwriting as it's developed, what I value the most about Prince is sort of his pop songwriting, but more like the way he engaged with the outskirts of pop music. I admire his ability to be at once a mainstream commercial artist and at the same time someone who's really pushing the boundaries of what is mainstream commercial art. In a way that I think I mentioned David Bowie. Bowie is the first other person that comes to mind that does what Prince yeah. did, or, you know, they both died, so that did what Prince did. That's kind of what, you know, like I don't think Prince would be like, I'm not a Michael Jackson guy. I like, you know, Off the Wall and Thriller are amazing albums, but I'm not you know, I'm just not a hardcore MJ fan, because what he did was he made amazing pop music, but like for me to really for me to connect with that on a deeper level, there needs to be some weirdness there, and that's what that's what Prince had. You know, he wrote these great pop songs, but he also, there was this whole undercurrent of subversion to what he did, that never entirely left. You know, there were definitely moments that the subversion was more evident than others, but he stayed weird to some extent right up to the end. And that, those were the moments on his later albums that I'd be like, okay, he's still here. You know, Artificial Age, it was like I had kind of fallen out of listening to Prince, and Artificial Age is like, this is my Prince again. You know, like there's all these segues
and June. I mean, June is just a phenomena. It's like, you know, so you're just going to produce this kind of incredibly, kind of whimsical but somehow incredibly moving meditation that you're going to spin out of Burning Pasta.
Pasta simmers on the stove in June. Makes no sense yet, but it will soon. Conversation starters come way too hard. Nobody wants to be the martyr, playing the wrong cards. Why did you come to this planet? Why did you come to this land?
Right, it's crazy. Yeah.
I mean, it's like I, you know, when we get to the awards at the end, I mean, it gets a special mention for the making of poetry out of pasta. And it's like, what is going on with that? I you know, I mean, yes, okay, fine. I'm totally on board with that.
So, I mean, I didn't do a great job of weaving that in with my history, but you know, just briefly, I was born in 84, summer 84 is the same summer that Purple Rain came out. I did not see Purple Rain as an infant. it's my understanding that, that 1999 and, you know, the side projects from the early 80s were in pretty heavy rotation while I was, you know, in utero. And you know, of course, when I was growing up, you mentioned, you know, there was the triumvirate of Prince, Madonna, Michael Jackson. So I was as much aware of When Doves Cry and Raspberry Beret and Kiss and, you know, all of those songs as I was of Like a Virgin and Vogue and, you know, Billie Jean. So, you know, so Prince was always kind of part of the landscape. But I was a little young for when he was at his most relevant, you know, content wise, he was certainly not appropriate for me to be listening to. And around the time,
many parents have struggled with that.
Right. although I was at a good age, a reasonably good age for the Batman soundtrack, because that came out in 89. I was too young to see the Tim Burton Batman movie, but I still saw it because that was before like parents really understood what PG-13 meant, and also what Batman meant. You know, my parents were kind of expecting something a little more Adam West than what they got. So I mean, I definitely remember the Bat Dance video, and I have this weird like phantom memory, you know, the scene in the movie where the Joker, Jack Nicholson as the Joker, is dancing on the float to Trust. For the longest time, I thought it was Prince, which in retrospect is hilarious. You know, like in my mind, it was Prince on the float because I hadn't seen the movie in so long and I remembered the song. You know, a middle-aged Jack Nicholson and a, you know, still reasonably in his prime, Prince, are two very different things. But for whatever reason, that's what I remember.
It's definitely a different type of charisma. Going on
there. Right, exactly. Trust, who do you trust? What makes you a real lover? Trust. And then around the time that it would have been ideal for me to get into Prince, you know, like 12, 13, 14, you know, early teens, he was kind of not very accessible.
Doing,
you know, yeah, he was doing something different. Yeah. He was, you know, much more, I mean, when he was. I mean, so yeah, I was 12 in 96, and that was Emancipation, mm-hmm. which is an album that I wasn't able to comprehend, you know, until like at best, you know, after I turned 30, it's like, I kind of got it because it's a very domestic record. So it's like, oh, you know, this is Prince kind of slowing down and starting a family. I first tried to listen to Emancipation in my 20s, it was like, what is this? Like, how, like, there's three albums of this. Like, it sounds like smooth jazz, you know, it was the antithesis of what I thought was cool about Prince at the time.
Yeah.
I think it
may still be the antithesis.
Right. It definitely is. Even if I understand it, it's not my Prince. Actually becoming a Prince fan was probably around 2004. And, it's tough to really, so, you know, musicology was happening. So he was kind of coming into the public eye in a way that he hadn't been. I know that he didn't like musicology being described as a comeback, but his previous album had been a, you know, a jazz funk concept album about Jehovah's Witness theology.
I
mean,
still in heavy rotation, that one.
Right, like, it's not top 40 material, so I mean, it was a comeback, realistically speaking. I'm not sure. I think part of it was, you know, I was kind of a late bloomer in terms of relationships. So honestly, part of it was I was dating in my freshman year of college, and it's in, you know, Prince, like, for me, Prince and relationships are inextricably connected. Prince is the
I'm
only.
I'm sure we shall get onto this at some length.
Yeah, Prince is the only artist that, you know, when they died, I contacted two of my ex-girlfriends. Like, it's so strange. You know, as a teenager, David Bowie spoke to me more, but as a young adult and as someone who was, you know, coupled, Prince spoke to me much more.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of all the tweets after his death about, like, well, look, he's 33% your father.
Right.
You know, how many human beings this man has brought into existence.
Yeah, exactly. And that might be part of, you know, why I think you mentioned he felt kind of close to us, despite the fact that he was also, you know, sort of like a hermit living in a mansion in Minneapolis, you know, who for a good chunk of both of our lives had a name that was literally unpronounceable. And yet there is like this intimacy with him. That I think a lot of people, especially women, like you mentioned, but men also, you know, a lot of people felt.
Yeah. I mean, I think it has similar and also kind of different modalities. I mean, when we get to talk about Ben's book, I'm gonna go on probably at great length about the specificity of his relationship to four women.
Right.
But But yeah, I mean, I think in general there is a sense of intimacy, and I think it partly relates to the songwriting. I mean, I think one of the things that I had on my list, we were talking about like pop song craftsmanship. I think for me, it's more the singer songwriter. It's the synthesis of the rock god, and the kind of groove master and the sensibility of a singer-songwriter.
Right.
You know, I was raised on Kate Bush and Joni Mitchell and mm-hmm. Tori Amos.
Mm-hmm.
And he has that. He has that in him. And not only in the structure of the songs, but in the kind of the subtlety and the emotional expressiveness and the kind of tenderness. And to be able to do that at the same time, or not necessarily simultaneously, but within the same artistic space,
right,
as the other things, as particularly, I mean, there's two things for me: that the kind of singer-songwriter sensibility, and then the other is the kind of capacity for ecstatic expression.
Yeah,
both through the rhythmic work, and I mean, it's interesting because when Susan Rogers made that point about melody and my, because some of the melodies are beautiful, but it's the groove for me.
Right.
Really. Like, that's what really compels me. To hold all those things together, like some of the live versions of Something in the Water, even from 2014, 2015, and actually then he can put it together in a whole piece of work. There is the kind of singer-songwriter sensibility, there's like beautiful jazz vocalist sort of touches, plus an incredible funk groove, plus incredible guitar work, like all put together. And you know, they're nine minute pieces, 12 minute pieces, some of them.
Yeah.
And it hits all the marks. Like it has the expressiveness, it has the lyrical content, it has the funk in it, it has like the guitar pyrotechnics, like it's all there. I mean, there is not that many places where all of those elements come together, but there are some places when they are. And them individually as well. And I think that's why, I mean, for me, it's not so much the pop song craftsmanship as the more the singer-songwriter style craftsmanship, which I find really compelling. Some of the ballads are phenomenal.
Yeah.
And when we were doing the genre list and I was trying to choose the ballads, I was like, this is impossible. Like, I can't get a piece of paper between like a good 20 of them. So yeah, and I think that's, that kind of range is exceptional. I mean, it's like, I mean, I wrote something in my notes, you know, it's like kind of finding out that Giorgio Moroder and Jimmy Page and Kate Bush are all the same person.
Like, right. Yeah, because
like, how do you do that?
Because I mean, we have we have so much respect for people who can even do one of those things. You know, like
exactly.
Like James Brown was just like peerless at creating a groove. You know, he basically invented funk, but James Brown could never write a song like Purple Rain or you know, like the Ballad of Dorothy Parker.
Or any of those things. In which also, I mean, there's also these incredible moments, like, you know, the Ballad of Dorothy Parker, in which I kind of inadvertently invented proto drum and bass, and then just forgot to do anything, with it, because that was just that,
right?
You know, or like, you know, or like Purple Music, in which I kind of anticipated Deep House by 5 years and then just put it in the vault and didn't bother. Yeah, whatever. Kinds of moments in it as well. You're like, dude, like, you know, it's that is just mind-blowing. And you take that, like, you know, so, you know, okay, I'm Giorgio Moroder and this and Jimmy Page and Kate Bush and like a bunch of other things, and then on top of that you have, you know, the whole sexual spiritual charisma thing, and then you have it all wrapped up in this kind of immaculate like movie star presentation. So it's like, oh, and then on top of that, I'm also, you know, like Valentino and Audrey Hepburn and, you know, Gianni Versace as well.
Right. Like, yeah.
There's a thing about the completeness, which, you know, and it seems, you know, it seems an obvious point, but it is just mind blowing, you know.
Right.
And the fact that I can just, people keep coming in and going, what's this? And I'm like, it's Prince. You know, I was playing, we were just having lunch and I was playing the Andy Allo album, like the you know, the Weekend Love stuff, which, and, you know, we're like, oh, why didn't you just put, we just wanted you to make albums in which you played acoustic guitar. Like, this the thing about, you know, the piano microphone tour. It's like, thank you. Just sit down and play, dude.
Right.
Like, we just want you to play. Like, you don't actually have to do anything. You just need to play. Like, that's it. Like, and if you wear a beautiful suit and some lovely sparkly earrings while you're playing, that would be great. But we just need you to play. And I think it's quite interesting, you know, in terms of people who knew him would say that. I mean, that he would just sit down and play. And they were like, why don't you just go and play? Like, you don't actually need, it doesn't actually, you know, it's great that it has all this elaboration. And I understand that he needed to do that. And I think that's what's interesting also about the kind of chameleonicness. There's this kind of, there's the one sense in which, as you say, lots of people have different princes because there is this massive range.
Right.
And, you know, there's a kind of branch in criticism as well, which we'll talk about, particularly like the vocal range and the fact that the vocal range can be interpreted as a kind of, you know, deconstruction of subjectivity. And like, there is no prince because there is no single, because we have this and we have everything from the modified, you know, Camille falsetto to the modified basso profundo and like everything in between. And, you know, you can write a nice piece of analysis about how this, you know, this is indicative of the, you know, the lack of centering of the subject or what have you. And I find that really interesting because on the one hand, that's true. And on the other hand, it always, even when he's doing something I don't like, it still feels like him.
Right.
You know, it still sounds like him. Like there's nothing in that vocal range. There's nothing, you know, from the screams to the whatever, to the whispers and the gasps and this and the very highness of the falsetto and the, you know, the very bottom. And it all, returning to this point about what it is we connect with or the sense of intimacy, it's that there's something in it that just, it still feels, like it still feels like him. So I find that tension quite interesting between the sense of connection with something that, you know, we would hesitate these days to call authentic, but feels real, and this kind of very elaborate performance and amount of artifice and massive kaleidoscopic range and like vocal variation, which presents this idea that there isn't a singular person there.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting in itself as well.
Maybe I think you need to slow down. Come in, let me talk to you. Open relationship, are you crazy? You know what I want.
In many cases, I mean,
cool.
When people talk about the comeback after 2002, mm-hmm. it's principally a live comeback.
Right.
Like, what happens is his performance regains the kind of electricity that it had in the 80s.
Yeah.
That doesn't carry back over into the recorded music.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned.
I mean, even musicology, at the time, it was this is Prince, but it's not an album I ever listened to. Frankly,
no, you don't. I mean, I listen to selected tracks from Artificial Age and from the last two Hinrun albums,
right?
And that's actually about that's still all. I mean, it and what's interesting, I mean, also in relation to the 90s work, yeah, it's interesting mm-hmm. which songs he kept in the repertoire from those, because there were some great songs in there. And yeah. there are some great songs from the late 90s, you know, I love you, but I don't trust you anymore. Mm-hmm. Like when I lay my hands on you, like those things that stayed or were carried from like the early noughties into the repertoire. The live performances of those songs are phenomenal.
Yeah.
But after hearing those live performances from, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2011, whatever, I went back and listen to the originals, and I'm just like, nah.
Right.
Why would I listen to this when I can listen to the Montreux performance, or listen to the performance from North Sea Jazz?
Yeah.
Because you nailed it there, and actually, there is still a question, and I think it comes back to that issue about collaboration and self sufficiency in the studio, and how that was working during the 80s, and how it continued. Or didn't continue to work, like into the future, and the extent to which Purple Rain was a collaborative album,
yeah.
Parade was a collaborative album, Sign of the Times was a collaborative album.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about what was produced when he was working in close musical collaboration, which was recreated in performance situations, but somehow never went back into the studio in the same way.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the whole story, but I think it's part of the story. And I mean, that's interesting in itself in terms of, you know, discussions we can have about his psychology that we will probably get onto at some
right.
point later on.
But right.
but that's a real tension. That's a real tension. And his greatest studio work was produced in collaboration, possibly with the exception of Dirty Mind Controversy and 1999.
And that's a defining, I mean, you know, that it's a defining tension in his work, even if there are cases where there seems to be a, you know, it's almost like the exception that proves the rule. Like there is definitely, there's a kernel of truth to this idea that he could do it all himself, but
yeah.
I think his music and his, I mean, even his worldview, you know, really benefited from letting other people in.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's why I'll always prefer the Revolution to the New Power Generation. Even if the New Power Generation were, you know, they were better musicians, you know, by in terms of technical, like how many notes they can play or, you know, how they can maintain a groove with each other. But they were also hired guns, you know, and so like that's it, that makes all the difference to me. The Revolution were
and yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think they said that in one of the interviews that they gave shortly, you know, in the last year. I can't remember exactly where it's been in the last year.
Yeah.
That they were the last band that he was in.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. And I think it's important in terms of the trajectory. Because I mean, we've talked about this, but I think something quite significant happens around the end of 86 into 87. I mean, we tend to forget that Sign of the Times was essentially made in 86.
Yeah, yeah.
And the drop-off, if there is a drop-off, happens after that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, there are moments, you know, it's not a straight trajectory. But the tensions definitely start bubbling around that time, and those tensions play out or don't play out or get resolved or don't get resolved, like over the next, well, until the end, really.
Yeah.
Wendy? Yes, Lisa. Is the water warm enough? Yes, Lisa. Shall we begin? Yes, Lisa.
About that story is that that's that issue about the tension between collaboration and non-collaboration is the plot of Purple Rain, or one of the plots of Purple Rain.
Yeah,
you know, the redemptive moment comes from him allowing people to contribute, from, you know, from dropping the boundaries,
right?
And that's how he's saved.
And it's so interesting that he made that movie with full awareness. You know, he didn't literally write the script, but he was there for every, you know, step of the process. He had a lot of control over that film's story. He makes that movie in 83.
It's staggeringly predictive. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about it. You know.
Yeah.
The extent to which the observation of the dynamics that existed and, you know, and the way in which it reaches a resolution which is exactly the opposite of the resolution which actually leads to the end of the revolution.
Right.
Which is him just being, I can't cope with this amount of teamwork.
Right. Yeah, before we kind of had a whole conversation before we turned the microphone on, but so I'm going to try to just like crudely summarize it. But Jane, I think you mentioned Prince had a tendency, and kind of an aggravating tendency, to be so incredibly prescient and self-aware in his music, and I would even, you know, to incorporate Purple Rain, we can even expand that to art in general. He could cut to the heart of his psyche and then just kind of say, well, that's done, you know, and then like not learn from it in his life. Like it's
I mean, it's almost, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there's a It's one of the tensions I find really interesting. I mean, one of the things I find, there are many things I find interesting, obviously, because I've been obsessing about it for a year. but one of the things I find interesting is actually also the tension between the things, the contradictions in his personality, or between his personality and his work, where there are real tension. And then also the fact that you have these the ability to hold together things in tension. So yeah. The classic thing is, you know, the masculinity and femininity, the black and white, so we can, you know, there's a standard analysis about, you know, and he advocated this quite clearly in places. Like, there's early interviews where he's like, I don't like purity, I don't like categories, blah, blah, blah. Mm. We know all of this. Yeah. So there's on one hand, this very clear decision to hold conflicting things together. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, there are real conflicts. Mm-hmm. And it's one, sometimes it's quite hard to decide which of the conflicts are real conflicts and which of the conflicts are things that are actually being held together quite well. And sometimes he seems to be able to hold things together, which then he can't.
Right.
So there's that which is interesting about the tension itself. And one of the tensions, you know, so there's this tension between a kind of desire for, or a kind of anti-purity, anti-category thing, and then there's a desire for certainty and clarity and, you know, salvation, and those kind of pull against each other.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's this real tension between expression and repression, which I find really fascinating. And like, you know, I mean, we've talked about this, but I'm really obsessed with the hallway speech. Because it kind of, you know, he lays it all out there, you know, it computer yeah. is an interesting song. I mean, and to a certain extent, if you don't listen to the full version, if you just listen to the album version, you know, it seems a bit throwaway, not musically, but
right.
as a piece of songwriting.
Right. I mean, it's one verse
and it's really
basically
not.
Is what he left. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really not. It's almost like his entire psychodrama in a nutshell.
It's crazy.
When
yeah.
he's 24 years old.
Right.
And then he just doesn't do anything with it. And you're just, he's like, there's something wrong with the machinery. I have this problem with women. They keep leaving me. I don't want them to. I can't work out the difference between love and lust. There's something wrong with the machinery. What is it to do with? It's to do with there's all this stuff buried in my psyche. If I show it to people, they're going to abandon me.
Right.
I really need to work out how to reprogram myself. And then I just won't.
Just let that simmer for the next, you know, 20 years.
I'll just let that simmer for the next 30 right. odd years.
Yeah.
And instead of actually doing something about it, I'll tell these increasingly elaborate stories about demons and, right. and sin and salvation and
right.
haunting and infestation and like where do the demons keep coming from? And it's like, you know where the demons keep coming from. You knew when you were 23
right.
where the demons
yeah.
are coming from. You walked someone down it and you pointed at all of the corridors and you gave them names. You
right.
know what this is.
Didn't like coming home alone, but the house where he lived had many holes. There was a long walk to his bedroom, because to him, each hallway represented an emotion. Everyone vastly different from the next. One day while she was with him, he decided to name each one as he passed through them. She was at his side, one hand on his thigh. No, wait. She was sort of half a step behind him. Yeah. The grip on his thigh intensified as they walked slowly through the corridor. He named the hallway Lust. And as they passed through the next one, he named it Fear. The grip she now loosened it, so he walked fast. Her hands now trembling, she let drop to her side as he wrote the word Insecurity. He looked in her eyes and smiled a demon smile and quickly walked on to the next. Corridor after corridor, he named almost all when suddenly he stopped. He painted the word Eat. She was gone. So he painted the last of this.
It's almost like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, or something gets, you know, it's like we were saying, there's you know, there's the accounts of the extent to which in his personal life he was almost entirely non-introspective.
Right.
Which is kind of crazy for somebody whose entire, you know, being is directed towards the processing of their psyche through art.
Yeah,
man. And you're kind of like, that I find really fascinating. It's almost like, okay, so I've processed it, I've done it here, and it doesn't go anywhere
right.
else. So you have this kind of really interesting relationship between the vulnerability that's expressed in the work and is really evident and not concealed, and the very, very clear failure to deal with those kind of vulnerabilities in life leading to situations that
yeah.
you know, we know about, which we can talk about at greater length. towards the end, when we talk about the end. But yeah, I mean, those tensions I find, you know, and I think it's interesting in relation to this whole kind of to what extent he is an enigma, because, you know, we've talked about that as well, the extent to which there's this kind of popular narrative about him being so enigmatic,
mm-hmm.
whereas the fan relationship to him is really not about that. The fan relationship to him is very much modulated around how close to him they feel,
yeah.
and how identified with him they feel, and how he feels like a friend, and the level of connection that they experience. And also, you know, how that then ripples out in terms of how the fan community has dealt with his death, and the kind of stonewalling around that, and what information there is and what information there isn't.
Right.
So you have that on you know, on one level, and there is this kind of sense of intimacy, and it's in the work. And he says, it's all in the work. Like, I'm not concealing anything. Like, mm-hmm. it's all in the work. And he was right.
Yeah, a lot of the times when artists say that, it's not accurate.
No, it's really,
with
it's
Prince,
really
it really is. Like, it's, especially if you listen yeah. to the stuff that's been leaked, like, it's all yeah. out there.
it's all out there.
Yeah.
And you know, Susan Rogers said this in an interview that she gave afterwards, where they were asking her what should be done with the stuff in the vault, and she was like, just release it all.
Right.
Like, release it all. Like, there's nothing hidden. It's like, we know who you are.
Right.
Like, we already have enough to know who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At this point, the privacy is gone.
More than enough. Like, the right. Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about this with Mighty's book as well, I think. But that's what was kind of interesting about Mighty's book, is how recognizable he was.
Yeah.
It was like, yes, this is exactly the person who I think you are.
Right.
And you know, and so that still then raises these questions about, what were you concealing? Like, did you... There's kind of, you know, it's like we can all see it.
Mm.
We can all see it. You're not hiding anything, and yet at the same time, you are hiding something.
If you were given a whole thing and some, when you stop to wonder why. But how will you know the truth? Yeah. Everybody's got a right to love. Everybody's got a right to lie. But the choice you make, it ain't no piece of cake. It ain't no motherfucking piece of pie.
So yeah, there's issues around that. Anyway, is there anything on my list of things about why I think he's important? I have a few more things on my list. Artistic commitment and fearlessness, which I think is, I mean, and again, this relates to the whole being a mainstream superstar plus a kind of cult figure.
Right.
How he managed that. And again, sometimes he managed it really well, and sometimes it was a tension that was really difficult, I think. But one of the things I have real respect for is that in the kind of insane whirl of becoming a star of that magnitude, he didn't lose it.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't lose his understanding and connection to himself as an artist.
Yeah. And he made demands on people who were, you know, like authority figures that are almost unfathomable. Like, the fact that he could go to a record label at 19 years old and say, I want to produce myself. And if you don't, you know, if you don't want me to produce myself, then I'll walk. Like, I'm not signing this contract. I mean, it's, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, I feel like I say that a lot about Prince, but it really is. Like, he was not a normal person in so many ways, you know?
No, no. And and he really wasn't. He really wasn't. That level of productive, like being in process. I mean, I think that's one of the things I have so much respect for him. Like, his own connection to his own, even when he wasn't making things that I think are great, I still have respect for how committed he was to his own process. Yeah. Like, above and beyond everything else, above and beyond image, above and beyond success and money and recognition, he really cared about his process. And he also really cared about other people's processes.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of, I mean, and we can be cynical about the Svengali stuff, and, you know, there's lots of questions about that as well. But particularly in his later years, I think his desire to, like, mentor people and encourage them and pass on his wisdom and help younger artists work out how to lead productive, meaningful, creative lives, that was absolutely genuine. And the amount of money he put into, you know, funding for music for young people and any kinds of schemes that would help people learn how to use creative process to, you know, help them develop. I think there's something about what he learned about his own creative process and how it had transformed the possibilities of his life that was really key and central, and that he wanted to be able to give to other people. And I think that was absolutely genuine. And, you know, we live in a world where, you know, everything is reduced to, you know, utilitarian calculations and productivity and efficiency and the extent to which he was like, no, this is all bullshit.
Right.
Like, you know, like, make work, engage in meaningful activity, just keep doing it. Do it as best as you can. It will give you joy. It will heal your soul. Keep doing it. That I love about him.
And that's something that has just aged so well. Like, it's almost looking back at the symbol period. I mean, you know, it was definitely an idiosyncratic way to get out of a contract and to, you know, wage a dispute with his label. But it's funny how, like, bewildered people were at the time. It was, you know, people genuinely thought he was going crazy. Looking at it in retrospect,
I mean, I think he was also going crazy. I think there's two things going on.
Right.
I think there was. I mean, if you think about how much weight he lost and how strung out he looked, it really got to him emotionally.
And I think there's a case to be made that was kind of when his, you know, prescription drug issues were starting to come to a head. So there was definitely a little bit of that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think it affected him emotionally. Really, really profoundly, but I don't think he was wrong.
Right. And so much more of it makes sense.
It's possible. It makes a lot more sense now. I mean, he could have done a better job of explaining it at the time.
Well, yeah.
I'm not sure he was able, maybe. I mean, he did a pretty good job of explaining it later. And then obviously as the music industry shifted, you know, and I think, you know, in terms of the way in which, you know, a certain version of kind of neoliberal capitalism has come down the pipe and affected people and affected our ability to have respect for, like, the integrity of people's activity in and of itself, for itself, for its own value. That, I mean, he was a little bit, like with many things, ahead of the curve in that. So I think it made a lot of less sense in a lot of ways than it does now.
Yeah.
And I think most people understand it now. And I think it was difficult because I think his communication of it was impeded by the fact that I think it was very emotional for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it really got to him.
And we can
speculate about why, but.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of I may have to edit this out because I don't think this will go over well with a lot of people, but it reminds me a little bit of Kanye West in that he frequently is saying something like the third or fourth time that he rephrases it because he's offended everyone. It's like, that made sense. Like, I get what you're saying, but he is so. He struggles to articulate it in ways that the rest of the world understands. And if I do keep this in the podcast,
we're not really comparing.
I'm not saying just that Kanye can shred like Prince can, or you know, like I know they're on different levels in many ways, but.
Yeah, in many ways. But I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I have a, you know, it in part of the whole kind of wandering around in his psychology that we have engaged in over the last year in an attempt to understand what happened, that I think it was a trauma response. Like, I mean, the whole building worlds and controlling his environment in certain ways was very much about him not being able to tolerate anyone having power over him, anyone having control over him, and particularly not when it messed with his process. And when those things came to a head, and there were other issues there, I mean there were a bunch of other issues as well that kind of went into the mix, but it really triggered, I think it really triggered something, because I don't think his modulation of the way that he did it was the most effective. And it's possible to be having a traumatic response and be right at the same time. And I think he was right.
Right.
But I think the emotion that it was imbued with affected the way in which he modulated the presentation of it. And it could have gone over easier for him.
Yeah.
If he'd been less angry,
right?
I mean, he was furious. He was furious. And generally, fury is not the most effective way of doing the
work. Yeah,
I'm not judging him. I mean, I've been there. Like, I mean, I think everyone has.
Right. Yeah. It's productive, but maybe not in the not in the way that he needed to be productive at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just thinking if there's anything else I have. I mean, there's a lot of. I mean, I've mentioned the ecstasy stuff, and we can talk about that. And then I have an entire page of notes on what is subtitled "God, Sex, Magic," which maybe we can talk about when we get to Ben's book, because I have a few things to say about that.
Yeah.
I think that kind of covers. Let's have some music.
We'll be back next week with part 2 of my conversation with Jane Claire Jones. Thanks.